So this is continuing with Henry Palmer on 18th August 76.
Yeah. So, anyway, he said, well, I'll write the verse, and the net effect of that was I moved at 1 point. And I sent my set of tickets back, and I told Professor Marshall, I said, sorry, thank you very much.
So you ended up with which position, finally?
Well, that was in those bad old days, the university used to appoint rather more assistant lecturers than they had lecturers.
Right.
Shortly after I finished that, they abolished the grade of assistant lecturer, and they now appoint lecturers on probation with the confident expectation that they'll be continued.
Mm-hmm.
So in those days, and in my case, you said 3 years on probation, 3 years assistant lecturer, 3 years on probation as a lecturer, so 6 years before you got what Americans would call tenure.
I see.
Anyway.
So you got tenure out of.
No, so I got tenure in 58, after 6 years.
So what you came away from then was with,
from that
was with a lecturer?
I had a lectureship on probation.
Right. Let me ask you, what was it that you found exciting in radio astronomy?
Why did I prefer it to meteorology?
Right.
Well, all the arguments I mentioned to you earlier.
Okay.
I mean, it's still true that there's an awful lot of literature in meteorology. I felt that the place in Montreal, Marshall McGill, was as good as there was to be found in meteorology, and that radar weather was a good thing and so on, but didn't have nearly the instant excitement to it. Couldn't have, really. And I mean, I'm right. The major advances in meteorology in the last 20 years is the application of computing forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you call cloud seeding an advance or not, but
right.
I mean, there haven't been any really major things in cloud seeding, so if they haven't been done by large teams, you see, and whereas in radio astronomy there is an open field for the
right
one or two persons. Also, there was a much more basic approach to the electronics, the McGill stuff. Of course, I was only a visitor, but it seemed to me they were working much more on ready-made equipment,
off-the-shelf
equipment. I was, in those days, and still am, perhaps, much more interested in developing new instruments. In those days, very much interested in that.
Right.
Growing out of my house.
Let me ask about a publication in here in which you looked for polarization in Cygnus gas and Taurus.
Yeah.
At 1.9 meters. What was the reason for this? What was the reasoning? Were you spurred on at all by the Russian synchrotron theories? That's what I'm mainly interested in. Which you were being too.
Well, look, you must understand that at that period, Hanbury Brown was a man that picked the projects. Thompson and I carried them out.
Mm-hmm.
He said that, I think he would have found that is the first radio polarization ever.
Non-solar. That could well be.
I think that is right, and I think Hanbury Brown recognized that and realized it would be a good first to collect.
So he's just going to just see what's there, not necessarily to.
I expect he knew about the Russian stuff. I certainly don't remember very much about it.
Well, I can ask him about that, too.
So I would say he just spotted that. I'm fairly sure he probably did know about the Russian stuff and reckoned that detection or an upper limit on polarization would be a good thing to collect, and that the way we would try and do it would be a good way to do it.
Were there any special problems with it?
Well, it was done with two scissors aerials, if you like, and if you look it up, you'll find it's two 30-foot aerials. It was the one off the. We had a 30-foot aerial off the Festival of Britain. Well, that was one of the few things that was ever used for, and I've forgotten where the one came from. But it was a muddy business.
Now, when you say off the Festival of Britain, you mean that you got money because of it?
There was a scheme. I was in for Jodrell Bank to supervise equipment to observe radio waves from the sun at Festival River. And there's a 100-foot thing called the Shot Tower, which they made their shot on in London. And there was a scheme to mount a 30-foot aerial on the top of that tower in London, probably. Now, this was a festival scheme, you see, in 1951. Receive radio waves and demonstrate them to a
marble down the bottom.
Well, I don't know what you do with it. But anyway, most of it didn't work. I think that's probably true. But the telescope was erected. The Royal Engineers, I believe, took it halfway up the chimney and dropped it or something. I mean, the great fun was had all round. This jolly thing, you see. And at the end of the day, when the exhibition was over and done, the telescope finished up at Jodrell. Like so many directors, I think somebody looked out and said, look, what's the roof we ought to put it on? Put it on top of what is known as the engine house, which was the main entrance to Jodrell in those days. So you drove up the main entrance, and there was a 30-foot telescope sitting on the top of the engine house. Thompson and I were probably, well, I wouldn't say, the first people to use that. And we use it as an interferon element. As far as I remember, it was a transit device without Rolf. Perhaps it wasn't. Perhaps that's the whole point. That was a still device. And we had another dish, which I think was probably a 10-foot dish, which was manually moved around. I mean, it was moved about, changed the baseline, and it was steered physically to direct it.
Was this Rod Davies' dish also? I mean, the one that he used? No, that's another one.
Yeah. I've been Rosen's. Might very easily have been Rosen's. I've forgotten that. I think Rosen used a 10-foot dish. And I think it might have easily been that. Possibly before Rosen got hold
of it. I thought you said it was 25.
And for an infront, you need two. And the 25-foot on the engine house was certainly one of them. If it was 25 or 30. It was a festival dish.
Right.
And the other one was a 10-foot dish.
Okay.
And I can sort of visualize the sort of saucer shaped mount it was on and what a muddy job it was shifting it. I'm not sure which dish it was.
Now, when you were talking about these
And it was a standard prompt, and we would just have cross polarized feeds. I think coaxial relays just change over.
When you're talking about the successively longer baselines before, what was the movable element in those cases?
Oh, for that, we built. I built. I learned an awful lot about dipoles and so on. An array, which I think was 4x5 full wave dipoles. So how did the net come out? And there were five per frame. There were five frames, roughly that shape, and the pivoted hearing was. You had to be able to tip it over the range of the transistors, which was about that. And you could put two on a lorry side by side, so two journeys would transport them to any place.
I see.
And you had one cable, and then you had a gadget to bring the four cables together. So there were five dipoles and the transmission line for the five. And that was what we used for all these baselines. Everyone knows baselines. But we didn't use it for the polarization because there's an argument that it wasn't polarized. It was single polarized. You wanted a dish with cross dipoles for that. Fortunately, I think even that was right. I believe that they have detected polarization, but it's at higher frequencies and at lower percentages than what we've quoted, I would say.
Yeah, that's probably true, although I haven't actually checked.
No, well, I think you would find that what we said was right on that occasion. But the thing that you could say was really, going back to this, if I might remember,
yes.
What is scary about this one, was that we published. It's these three greater lamps.
You're talking about the 57 Morris Palmer and Thompson
article. This one is 10,600. 147,196,295. The evidence behind those figures is a bit thin. because it was done with we had by those, it was all done with radio, of course, so that's 15 miles. Thompson had built UHF, VHF, Link at 200 megacycle, thereabouts. And I don't nowadays know what was wrong with it, but it was distinctly touchy. There was one glorious night when we got all three fringes.
Hmm.
And that was about two or three days before Christmas. We worked all through January and could not get any more fringes. And we worked really hard, and we brought it back, and we had, I mean, we couldn't get them at the long baseline, and we couldn't get them at, when we brought the aerial back, also, I've forgotten, but we had another aerial or something. We couldn't even get fringes at the short baseline, after about a fortnight. And nobody understood why not. And it was eventually established. I think it was myself that spotted it at the end of the day, that we had the terrible thing known as the mag slip going the wrong way.
Huh.
Which means that the theory is the fringes, the lobes follow the source, and you record the difference.
Right.
But I had said to Morris, tidy up so-and-so and Meccano, and he had done it, tidying up, without anyone noticing, had involved reversing the direction of the mag slip. And as a result of that, we never saw any fringes for about a month.
Hmm.
And we turned it round after a month when this relation spotted, we could see signals all right, which is the colour they had this one. But you never got anything quite as good a clearer case as on that one glorious night, you see. So I think at the end of the day, at the end of the period, we had maybe four good nights, and they were non-phase stable, so you couldn't really integrate them. So we did a scheme of folding them over and then integrating them. We persuaded ourselves that the four nights gave evidence of this, independent of the one good night.
Oh, yes.
Two together was justified publication, but of course,
which you're always a little bit worried about.
Always quite a bit worried, and we didn't. Now, we always intended, and we kept the aerials up at the Caterpillar for about a year, and we intended to go back, but when Thompson left by that time, and when we did eventually turn the link on and try to go back, we found that ITV, independent television, I mean, that Thompson had put the link in the band which had been cleared for independent television. They had started up in the meantime, so there was no hope of repeating those measurements.
Yeah.
So since then, we've been much more legalistic in working on license frequencies.
Right, yeah, Roseland was telling me about.
So far as links go.
That business.
And one of the first things we did we then set out to build a new interferometer to go with the Mark 1, which took about another 2 years. Those two papers are all, and the polarization is all that one did.
Right. Now, I was just going to ask, is this why this was published in Observatory, which is not the usual place to publish things, because you weren't quite certain of
it was thought to be a fairly small form.
Yeah.
Yes, I would say we weren't absolutely certain.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem to merit more fuss than that, really.
Right. Let me also ask, because sometime in here, Hanbury Brown left for Australia. And did you then essentially become the head of the...
Well, I would say he went and go to the Mark... let's go on. Rosen joined in about 58, didn't he?
Yes. Right.
And Hanbury didn't depart, well, I don't know, October 61? Might even have been early 62.
I see.
He was, you see... Palmer and Rosen and Morris, Palmer, Morris and Rosen, constructed and erected what was then seen as the new interferometer to go in the Mark 1. which had fixed out station telescope, drift stations. It incorporated the microwave link, which was the first one.
Right, you've told me about that. Right.
And it incorporated a carrier at a license frequency, 175, I think that's right. And that was, so we made that work to Goosey, which reproduced this lot, of course. And then I've forgotten just what year we bought a Pi link, which and went to Northridge.
Which was how many wavelengths?
Well, it was about 9,700 was effective. And I was about to say the first night we got that going, we carefully checked what was here, the heat, make sure it was in. And of course they were good and big in those days by that time, because there was bigger events. And the idea was never really achieved. It was the scheme was designed by Hazard that you should run three baselines simultaneously, which was going to be one cable link, a short one, Goosey and Northridge. But we never actually achieved that. We did run them all, but they were never simultaneous. Then that whole reconstruction took quite a long time. But we had finished that by 59, I would say. And we were arguing with Toss as to what we should do next. By this time, somebody, probably Rosen, had produced the Now, at some stage, we began to think it would be jolly nice to have a steel telescope at the outstation.
Mm-hmm.
And apart from the steering and all the rest of it, the real difference was that you needed a variable delay system. Mm-hmm. All the delay systems. Yes, that's right. All the delay systems for Goosey and Northridge were quartz crystals. Goosey quartz crystals. And they're not variable. At some stage, Rosen discovered that you could buy, and he bought, a variable mercury delay. And so by 1960, we had this delay, and we were convinced, I'm largely under Rosen's influence, that the way forward was through steerable aerials. And it was that stick-in-the-mud Henry Brown who insisted that we do a transit experiment to Halkin and a transit experiment to Lincoln. And, I mean, we compromised by doing we remounted those frames on a steerable base and took those to Halkin. But what we wanted in Maladette didn't come to very much. But when the transit aerials went to Lincolnshire, and there was another silly thing there that somebody realised that there was some argument we were going to be short of signal from noise, which I probably shouldn't have called when it was. So somebody said, why don't you put down two aerials? So we put a double aerial at Lincolnshire, a hell of a long thing, and it never did any better than single one because of the extra cable in. So.
Oh,
that's a complete waste of time. But nobody spotted it. I mean, we didn't put it together until it got there, so nobody knew. We did also, perhaps a bit later on, we did also take those rotating frames and a rotating mount out there. And that is what got the structure 295, which I regard as the major advance of that period.
And where was this now?
Well, that was done in the autumn of 61. We had, in 61, in 60 we did the Welsh one, Halkin. and that's reported also in the Zodiac, I think. I'm not sure.
I don't have 60, I have Nature.
Nature, all right, Nature. Yeah, this is Nature. Now, Lovell will tell you that's the one that led to quasars. That is the one that's acknowledged in the quasar papers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The 61 one, which we make, which we were very proud of, because it got to 1 second of arc and a few things like that.
In the Nature article in 60, you say that 7 sources have less than 3 arc seconds.
That's right, yeah. Well, now, that's the really small that. In Lovell's view...
It used to be a pretty qualitative matter, of course, as to what's small.
Yeah. But, I mean, his opinion is that it was that figure at that date was more significant than the 1 second of arc a year later. And he's written this out in detail in that book. I wouldn't know. But there is a very generous postscript to some American paper somewhere, which I think it's that which should be acknowledged, not one of 1 second. But Grossman and I had both on those videos been keen to get going on steroid chronometers, and we'd sort of come unstuck at Halkin, one way or another. And the way we came unstuck there, you know that tale, yeah? About the ship, about the pilots.
No.
Well, in the summer of 1960, we took 3 frames to Halkin on the North Wales coast, which was 36 miles, and we reckoned there was just about a line of sight, and we were. And we got the link going, and everything worked, you see, and we got the Hudson closing out there, and got a pass by. And we, in those days, we had the transit-telescope as well as the telescope, so we, both for Goostrey, Northwich and Halkin, used to set things going in the transit-telescope, and we got a fringe, and we started using the Mark 1, you see. And so we sort of shyly said to Lovell one day, perhaps it was May 1960, well, we got a fringe out of Halkin last night. So he said, oh, well, here, we have, you're going to have the Mark 1 at the weekend. And we had the Mark 1 for about 3 weeks, solid. I mean, the program cannot have been all that full in those days. Or he was very pleased with this work or something. And we had it for about 3 weeks, solid. And we worked fairly hard at that, which was then a very long baseline to us. And at the end of that 3 weeks, the system began to suffer from very serious interference. And we didn't understand where this had come from. And eventually somebody went to Halkin and listened to it on the headphones. And the interference was quite obviously pilot boats on the River Mersey talking to the oil terminals and ordering their breakfast and so on. It's all the important thing that goes on. So the question is, why did we get 3 clear weeks? And the answer is that there was a seaman's strike.
Rosen did tell me this.
He told us that. And they sent the lyrics and so on. Well, that's all perfectly true. And it was really that stopped us getting anything out of the still there at the time.
So. I see.
But we were, and we probably weren't organized altogether in other respects, but we did make it go. Well, so then it was handed around, and Lovell insisted we do it again to Defoe, to literature, with fixed aerials, which we regarded as old hat and uninteresting and so on. We got the 1 second mark, and we got papers published on that before the summer. And then we came back, and I think we got some steerable data, which we didn't understand. Perhaps Rosen told you about the second maximum, the second minimum. I think the situation was that we had...
On 3C-295?
295,
yeah.
He had 1 minute, and he hadn't got the delay range to look for where he thought there must be another one. He couldn't do that from the sky. And eventually we wrote to Marconi's, and they gave us an additional quartz crystal, which allowed us to get the extra range. And so the published data was obtained after I went to IAU-61. And when I came back from IAU-61, we had this correspondence, which was a bit slow with Marconi's. Eventually got they gave us, or lent us, I don't forget, the extra 250 microseconds, whatever it was. And we got the second thing on that.
Now, when you said the structure of 3C-295,
You meant the double components.
We measured the 4.2 sigma double structure 295, and nobody knew the first thing about it until that time.
Right. No, there were several other doubles known, but they were all
substantially bigger.
A few arc minutes or something.
That's right.
Right.
No, it was, the things you can say about that is it was 10 times smaller and 100 times fainter than Sirius, and it was a double.
Right.
And it turned out to have 10 times redshift, which was what you'd expect. So I've always felt that it was a substantial achievement, and got a bit peeved with my Cambridge colleagues who... I went to a symposium in Royal Society of Hematite in... Conversazione in London about them, and they got 295 plus all over the wall. I couldn't see what the hell they're making a fuss about. Anyway, there we are.
So, in terms of the scientific importance, would you say it was that this established that doubles were very distant, it was a very general sort of thing?
No, it established that 295 was a scale model of signals.
In other words, that the universe was full of Cygnuses, or at least out to the distance of 295.
I don't say that. It's obvious that there was one other source.
Right. Well, but it'd be unlikely that you would pick up just that there'd only be one. I mean,
well, we didn't know that many.
Yeah.
In those days, we knew three. And I think it would be found. I'm afraid I've forgotten. I think you would find, if you looked it up, 147. I'm sorry, there is a Rosen paper on all this. We had structures on all those three. But the really striking one we felt was the double of 295. The others were smaller and elongated, but they weren't.
Right. And these three sources now are the three in the 1957 observatory paper, right? Which is,
we started on those three.
Which is 3C 147, 196, and 295.
Yeah. Well, I think if you look up the paper of Rosen on steerable structures, I mean, as I remember that, we all published 295 because we were so jolly pleased about it, but there were about five other structures got out of that work, which probably included 196 and 147, and certainly included Cygnus, fine structure. And I've forgotten what the other two were, but there is a Rosen paper somewhere,
okay,
which has got five structures in it.
About 61 or two?
61 or two.
Right. Now, let me ask about, over this whole 10-year period that we've been talking about, as a consistent theme, obviously, is just to go to longer and longer baselines and see if you still get fringes, it would seem to me.
Well, the way I look at it, the consistent theme of Lovell and Henry Brown was longer and longer baseline. They thought they got a good thing and they should exploit it. The view of Palmer, Rosen, and Allen, I think Roger Pepper and Allen, was that we had a hell of a time trying to write a paper about that translator. I mean, the reason we went to Allen, really and truly, was that we couldn't make sense. We had a try at writing a paper on the 2000 and 9000 wavelength stuff, and I mean, papers did eventually appear on that, but the interpretation of those transit data proved extremely difficult.
And why was this?
Well, because one gamma per baseline per source doesn't tell you very much. I remember one version of that paper. I heard somebody say it this morning, I couldn't help smiling. We had the sources classified as probably single or double or complex. it didn't seem on very meager evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if you look carefully, you'll find one of the straightforward, well-behaved single sources, which we illustrate in one of those papers, is 3C273.
Oh, yes.
I mean, we didn't spot that until some years later, of course, but the reason we went to Hawking was that it seemed more straightforward to pursue the small ones then to try and understand the ones which we had resolved. And it was because of the main bulk of it we couldn't understand that Burst and I came to feel the need for tracking observations so badly, you see. But Lovell and Brown didn't seem to appreciate this so much, or they said it would come later or something.
The sources that were resolved, you were saying, it was just not a tractable problem as to what to do with it.
What to do with it, that's right.
Yeah.
We can report, and we did write a paper reporting all the values we measured. But there's pressures into the interpretation.
But one could say because so little of the UV plane was sampled that...
You didn't really know a lot more about it. You see, where you had the gene existing.
Yeah.
The only thing you could do. Now, even that's probably wrong. Because, I mean, in retrospect, the thing that's wrong with all that work is it was done within irrelevance. You see, and probably those estimates of visibility, they're certainly a lot lower than you would get if you believe what Hewish and Reed had said, 81 or 151.
What do you mean by linear?
They were linearly polarized areas at the two ends of the baseline.
Right. And what is
Faraday rotation.
Oh, when I say between the two.
Between the two.
In the ionosphere.
In the ionosphere.
I see.
You see?
Who thought of that?
No, well, we didn't have it then, but we do now. So we use circular polarized areas.
Oh, yes.
But all that stuff is done in linear areas, see, so it's probably wrong.
And how much would you estimate now that reduces the visibilities?
I really have no idea, but it does differ. I really don't know is the answer. We were very careful about it, about the analysis and so on, as far as we could, honest. But I should dare say it's 20% or 30% down.
Hmm.
Especially at the noise limit. But we have restarted some low frequency work recently, and one of my aims is to get this checked, but nobody seems to be checking it. It hasn't happened yet.
Let me ask you.
Well, it hasn't happened in any very substantial number of sources.
We're getting sort of to the mid 60s where I'm cutting things off, but I do want to ask you about, as you're going to these longer baselines, did the thought occur to you about going completely independent, what we call VLBI now?
Oh, yes. Oh, certainly.
At what stage would you say?
Well, you can have a number of very interesting discussions about that. I certainly, and Rosen, discussed it with Hanbury before he went to Australia, whether you could do it with crystal oscillators, or whether you couldn't. A bit later on, we heard about rubidium clocks. And we reckoned that if you had two rubidium clocks at 5,000, you could do it. Now, I wouldn't know just which year, but the way I see it, Lovell went to Russia about 1960. And he came back and he was trying to think of, and he wished to send a center report on this, about possible cooperative experiments between George Bank and radio stars in the Soviet Union. And one of these was a tape recording problem. And it's all written out in that report, which was about 62 or 63.
The Jodrell Bank internal report?
Or sent for us to.
I see. Is there a copy of this? I mean, that you could find in your files?
Well, I don't know. I'm not certain. That possibly. I mean, it certainly was sent at the appropriate time. And nothing very much happened. I went to Russia in 64, after the report went off, and they told us about how the Institute or something like that was working on the tape recording problems, and so on. Nothing very active was happening. And I there was some dispute going on as to whether we'd use the Russian plane stick, which they use for lunar tracking, or whether we'd use the thing in Crimea. And I think I definitely recommend, and in fact, that's all after dinner, actually. I recommend we use the thing in the Crimea, not the Betsy, because the frequency would be wrong, and the timeshare and everything. We were quite sure, Rison and I, we reckoned what the probability was, that you could. There were three ways of getting to Russia, I think. You could do it video feed, you could do it with 50 microwave links in series, or you could do it with tape recording. You reckon that you could make them all, you only had to try hard enough and they could all be made to go, you reckon. And the tape recording would probably be the best and easiest. And variant were the people who made the time sense as well. It's pure speculation, yes, but and it's probably wrong, I think, actually, but I used to suspect that a copy of that report, we certainly gave a copy of that report to Varian, to try and persuade him to give us some time standards, because we didn't seem to be able, likely to buy them. And the next thing that happened was that one day in September, a Canadian turned up at John. I don't know quite who, he might have been Locke or Michael, who knows. It happened to me today we were having what's known as our budget room for next year's SRC grant. It was really very funny, I mean, the whole of the corner stuff. Rosen and I talked to this fellow, Locke, if it was Locke, a Canadian, and they went along to Lovell, the next table, the next book, and said, there's a Canadian over there, talking about building a tape recording interferometer, like we've been suggesting, like in that Russian report, you see. Lovell said, is he big on it? Well, said, if it was, can't have that. Let's get on with that. And so at the budget meeting that afternoon, he said, what would it cost? So I suppose I said 50,000 or some large sum. You see? And anyway, the net effect of this was that the Jodrell Bank tape recording from scheme was launched, and Anderson was asked to do it. And he's always, well, anyway, the net effect was we got the money for the stuff in cooperation with Malvern over 2 years, as far as I was able. But it all got launched, all of a sudden.
Right, because of the Canadians.
That then, because of the Canadians, said they were getting on with it. In retrospect, I often wonder whether it was right or wrong, because in the event, we were third and last. And although we, the countries may have spent 100,000 on it by now, I think have a strong-minded person like Henry, I suspect, might have said, you're going to be last, you're going to waste a lot of time and effort, you should be reinforcing success rather than trying to get into that act. But it's not the way we saw it at the time. But we didn't put enough effort. I mean, or conversely, if you're going to do it, you put more than the man in the boil, you see, which is all we did.
Right. Now, can you remember what year this was with this budget meeting you're talking about? It must have been 64 or 5.
Well, no, I went to Russia 64, so 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. And the... And you were thinking of a videotape recording system like
Canadians? Oh, it was a videotape with various...
Right.
With rubidium standards. Mm. We were quite clear on that. And that's what we bought. And that's what Anderson built.
Right.
I mean, except it was different and last and everything else. But and as I say, I mean, eventually... Well, then, of course, a bit of administrative interference. There's this crazy scheme of going to Arecibo on the grounds it was the world's two biggest telescopes. I mean, it took 3 trips to Arecibo to see a peep out of it, you see? First 2 trips, nobody saw anything out of it. There was some useful, what I believe to be useful, but first track calibrations were done, job plans on solar, and I still feel there's one to be published. To some extent, that's my fault, in that I, well, you could say Anderson has been keen to publish them, but he never publishes anything unless you take a very heavy stick to him, and nobody did, so he didn't. He produced a marvellous story that Fort, the student who was with him, had taken all the data to Canada and would be writing the paper. They'd been telling that story consistently for 5 years. But when I saw Fort in 72, I said, look, if you don't get on with it, they'll come out in general bang angles and they'll be there. And I think they'd be right to that. I still think they'd be worth putting in the annals. I'm not sure they're worth putting anywhere else. Yeah.
Well, this sort of takes it to the point where I'm ending, but I'd like to ask you the general question of in 57 or so the Big Dish came into operation, right? And yet you've always been working sometimes with the Big Dish, but using the Big Dish as one leg of the infirm, is that right? Or
coffee, please, I'll drive the man back. I think you would find that the interferometer occupied about a quarter, let us say a quarter, of the time of the English for its first 2 or 3 years.
I see that much.
Mm. Yes, a hell of a lot of time. And that's what I was saying. 1 year I started analyzing it against vacations as well. But anyway,
was this part of the justification at all for the Dish that there would be. I didn't think so, yeah.
No. In fact, that was a major user because well, I was about to say there's not that much you can do to power. Without spectroscopy, I don't think there is that much. And there certainly wasn't that much that we could do in 1958. Yeah. We got some pretty pictures of that.
I know what you mean. I feel the same way, but it is.
For that reason, it turned out that the interferometer, the moment you made a baseline and thing work, there was plenty of telescope time. And it must have happened on 3 occasions. That we made a booster on Orphish work, and we had a sort of very active 2 months. Almost right. Straight away.
So although it was not part of Lovell's original scheme for the Big Dish, he was obviously very supportive of
this
whole program.
On the quite general grounds of being for success.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know how you measure success, but he went, that's a bit later on, he went to one or two Solvay conferences became fully aware that the information he got from this was well ahead of the rest. If one's being unduly modest, you can say that for 10 years we were a clear factor of 10, often a factor of 100, well ahead of the competition.
Right.
In resolving power. Now you can argue resolving power is not terribly important, and detail information which we didn't have perhaps was more important. What I said is still correct. We were a factor of 10 ahead of the competition, at least 10, for about 10 years.
Right. So, in fact, you really had no competition.
No. Except for poor old Carter in New South Wales, or wherever he was.
Was this because the other places could not develop the techniques, you think, or just because they had different scientific interests?
Well, it's still true today that there are only 2 radio linking interferometers in the world. One here, one at Green Bank.
And the one at Green Bank isn't used all that much, as you know.
Well, I don't know. I've heard Fomalhaut only isn't used that much.
Right.
I mean, it's a shame. I can't. And it's because people are lazy. That's the only reason why.
It's just a lot of work to trick.